Welcome to Crime Beat on the Artists First World Radio Network. Crime Beat, discussing the issues and controversies of the criminal world with famous personalities. Your hosts, Ron Chepsik and Will Hareb, will guide you into the deep underbelly of the criminal mind. To learn more about your hosts, their books, and past shows, visit the Crime Beat archive page. And now, your hosts, Ron and Will.
Good evening, everybody. My name is Will Hareb, your co-host and producer of Crime Beat. This hour-long broadcast puts you, the listener, into the back alleys and boardrooms of the world's most fascinating subject, crime. Our guests will allow you to experience their lives, and this is exactly where you want to be on Thursday night. And it's right here on Crime Beat, brought to you by the Artists First World Radio Network. Tonight, we're broadcasting live from the studios, our studios in Thunder Bay, Canada, sun-soaked Thunder Bay, Canada, and Rock Hill, South Carolina. Crime Beat this evening is delighted to announce the appearance of Tommy Reed, producer of the blockbuster hit documentary titled Super Thief. Mr. Reed will discuss Phil Christopher, the career criminal, mafia associate, and the most successful bank burglars in the United States history. In the second segment of our broadcast, we're privileged to bring you award-winning film documentary maker Mr. Yuri Lahovi, producer and director of Genocide Revealed. Along with Mr. Lahovi, we have Professor Robin Serban, one of the world's leading experts on the Holodomor. And it's going to be a great, great two-part series. Now, at this time, I'd like to introduce our listeners to my co-host and moderator and executive producer, the indefatigable Mr. Ronnie Chepsik. Ron's an award-winning author, documentary producer, and director publisher. He's the two-time Fulbright Scholar to Bangladesh and Indonesia, and a consultant to the History Channel's Gangland TV series. His book, Sergeant Smack, has been optioned for a movie. His latest project is the just-released documentary, The Frank Matthews Story, The Rise and Disappearance of America's Biggest Kingpin. For more information, please go to Strategic Media Books. That's www.strategicmediabooks.com. Given his books, his extensive travels, and in-depth interviews, Ron Chepsik today is the leading expert on the fascinating world of crime. Take it away, Ronnie.
Thank you, Willie. And here's a little bio on my co-host, Willie Reb. Willie is a freelance writer and broadcast journalist from Thunder Bay, Canada, who has assisted me on some of my crime books. Willie is currently involved in the international shipping business, where he is a contributing writer to several trade publications. Last year, he published Movers and Mavericks, an anthology about influential people from the Thunder Bay area. Volume 2 is coming out this year. Next year, he'll publish another book with Ellie Warner, another best-selling author, about the Ganalda shipwreck that sank 100 years ago in Rossport and Lake Superior. Willie?
Well, thanks for that, Ronnie. Great promo again. Really, really appreciate that. I'll tell you something, Ronnie. Just before we reach into our mailbag and read some of our mail we received, I'd like to thank all our listeners out there from around the world for tuning into Crime Beat. There's no turning back the clock now. We're thrilled and delighted to announce we've had overwhelming positive comments and thumbs up about our program. We're averaging over 130,000 listeners every week now, and it's certainly something to cheer about. I'd like to thank all our production people at Artists First World Radio Network, in particular Corey, Scott, and Tony, for making the show possible. Like I said many times before, Ronnie, Internet radio is the place to be. It's great to be recognized, and I guess it proves we're right on track. Well, now here's this week's mailbag. This one is from Lamont of Baltimore, Maryland. He writes, your show with Terry Tariba and those two guys from Poker Players Alliance was really good. You should have had Terry Tariba for an entire show to talk about that pipsqueak gangster Mickey Cohen. I enjoy the insights that the two poker gents have to offer as well. It's all about freedom of choice. If you want to go out there and lose your shirt playing online poker, you should be able to have that choice. Now, this one is from Terry Tariba herself. Terry writes, it was an honor to appear with you guys. You really have a lot of style. I would love to come on whenever you want. Please let me know. We do have some many, many more topics to discuss. Hey, some fine comments, Ronnie. Anything you want to add?
Really, and of course, we're going to get Terry back on the show as soon as we can. Yeah, pipsqueak Mickey Cohen. He was only 5'5". I wanted to work that into our interview with Terry to find out if that had any impact in the way he viewed the world, but didn't have a chance on that. And you know, the Poker Players Alliance was really an eye opener. You know, they want regulation. You know, they want to protect poker players out in cyberspace. And, of course, the opponents want to implement another form of prohibition like we had with alcohol in the 20s and early 30s, and, of course, with the war on drugs, which we got now. Well, so hopefully they'll be successful in getting their objective through with regard to legislation.
Well, prohibition never works, never worked, it'll never work. This is freedom of choice. This is what the American people want, and it's called freedom. Well, Ronnie Boyd, you want to give our listeners out there in that wide expanse of cyberspace a preview of next week's show.
Yeah, next week we got a really great fiction show. We have two authors on, crime fiction. We have Ed Falco. And if you haven't heard of his book, you're probably living on another planet. He's the author of The Family Corleone, which is another sequel in the Godfather series, and he's going to talk about this blockbuster novel. We'll also have on another best-selling author, John Land, and he has a book that just came out called Strong Vengeance. So it's going to be a really interesting show, a little twist on our programming. We usually do with nonfiction, but it's nice once in a while to have fiction authors on. Right, Willie?
I tell you, I read those two books. They read like nonfiction. I tell you, they're really good. I urge all the listeners out there to get those books. Well, Ronnie, I tell you, you're a busy guy. What have you been up to, and where are you going in the next couple of days?
Well, we had that interview last week on Burrow Bear, and it's on iTunes now. Anybody wanting to follow up on anything we say on the show can write us at crimebeat123@yahoo.com, and we'll gladly answer any questions or any requests. I'm not going anywhere for the next couple of weeks, but our publishing company is taking a big step. We got a national distributor we signed on, the Cardinal Publishing Group, and so it's going to give wider reach to our books. And we've had Seth Ferrante's wife on the program, Diane, and of course Seth serving a 24-year term in prison, and we got a collection of his blog writings, and I've edited them for publication. They'll be coming out in August, so we got a lot of things to look forward to, Willie.
Well, way to go, Ronnie. Good luck on that side. You're gonna end up going places, I'll tell you. A guy from the East End.
If I live to be 120.
Don't worry. You got longevity in your veins, man. Hey, I'll tell you, Ronnie, the Beat the Crime never stops. It never, never stops. Every week, just to get you in the mood, we present our rap sheet part of the program. Our rap sheet feature is a potpourri of news and events from the world of crime. Now, here is this week's rap sheet. Dateline, June 27th, 2012, New York City. Ex-U.S. president indicts Obama as an assassin. Hey, Ronnie, a column published Monday in the New York Times by Jimmy Carter himself, the 39th president of the U.S., constitutes an extraordinary indictment of the Obama administration for engaging in assassinations and other criminal violations of international law and the U.S. Constitution. Hey, man, this is pretty serious stuff. Hey, any comment?
Wow. You're telling me that's powerful stuff. Essentially, Carter's calling Obama a war criminal and a human rights violator, and he presents a lot of evidence. It's not just rhetoric, too. He talks about, you know, the implementation of warrantless wiretapping, electronic data mining, which has invaded the privacy rights of citizens. He's talking about making it illegal, Obama's right to detain any person indefinitely on suspicion of affiliation with terrorist organizations.
Yeah.
Or associated forces. You know, he talks about in his article about U.S. drone attacks, which have been successful. They've knocked off some of the Al-Qaeda leaders. That's a good thing. They've also killed hundreds, if not thousands, of innocent people as a byproduct of those strikes, and that's having a deleterious effect on U.S. foreign policy. And he goes on and on, you know. And don't forget Guantanamo. That was what Obama was supposed to close down. Yeah. And yet there's been over, 100 cases of waterboarding, which is considered torture by internet.
Yeah, well, this is all about, you're right, man. This is all about the rule of law. This revered 88-year-old wise guy, I mean, he's a wise man, let's say wise man.
Right.
He's telling it like it is, and I think he's got some backbone to this. Right. Anyway, we'll
If Obama was Bush, there'd be all kinds of outcry. But Obama's, left to center.
Yeah. That's
so he's
sure.
been able to, ironically, get away from it. The conservatives haven't criticized him on this. And, of course, there's been a lot of disenchantment with Obama on the left. And we'll see what happens if he wins a second term, if there's any change in direction in this policy, which is really disturbing. And thank you, President Carter, for pointing it out.
Willie? Yeah, you bet. It's a remarkable story. We'll keep an eye on this one. Now, just before we get on to our first featured guest tonight, Mr. Tommy Reed, we'll take a brief station identification. This is Crime Beat on the Artist First World Radio Network. Wherever you are tonight, we hope you enjoy our show this evening. Your hosts are Ron Chepsik and yours truly, Will Hareb. You can listen to our broadcast weekly on this internet band on Thursdays from 8 to 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. If you have a question for our guest, email us at crimebeat123@yahoo.com. We'll be happy to hear from you and try to incorporate your ideas into our future programs. Well, Ronnie, Crime Beat's first guest tonight is Mr. Tommy Reed, director and producer of the award-winning documentary titled Super Thief. Tommy Reed exposes the life of Phil Christopher, one of the most notorious bank burglars in U.S. history. It's going to be a great show, so stick around. You won't want to miss this one. Take it away, Ronnie.
Thank you, Willie, and welcome to the show, Tommy Reed.
Thanks, guys, for having me. I appreciate your time.
Great, and our audience, you know that you're the producer of a recent movie, which is a good movie. I really enjoyed it, Killing Irishman, right?
Yes, sir. That took me 13 years to bring to the big screen.
Wow, and how is it doing?
It's doing fantastic. Everyone, like those who were lucky enough to see it when its regional release in the Cleveland, New York, and some of the major cities. It came out on DVD this past summer and is constantly playing on Stars and HBO and all those stuff. And it's one of the top downloaded movies on iTunes. It's doing really, really well. The hearing the feedback is such satisfaction to myself, especially since it took me 13 years to bring to the big screen. It feels really good to have that kind of, to be recognized for something really good.
Right. Well, it's based on a Rick Perello book, and this documentary is also based on a Rick Perello book, right? And we've had Rick on the show when we first started out. He talked about the Killing Irishman on that, and that's been a very productive relationship, right?
Yeah, Rick's been great. I have a good eye for material, and I like to think that, I think very cost-conscious budgets with high commercial appeal. It's kind of like my MO as a producer. And I also go after projects that I want to find out more information. I'm fascinated with organized crime. Myself coming from the North Jersey area, being Irish and Italian,
Right.
The mafia gangster genre was a fascination of mine from a very young age, watching the Godfather trilogy and, the Goodfellas and Casino type movies, A Bronx Tale. I've always been fascinated by that type of story. So finding a piece, obviously Cleveland has a lot of that organized crime history, and it's never been told. So when I was a student at Ohio State, I tapped into northern Ohio area for organized crime and found out there was a plethora of information, the stories that I was very fascinated with, one of them being the Danny Green story, and then bringing that to the big screen. And now this one, Super Thief, about Phil Christopher and, himself being a master burglar and being the mind behind the biggest bank burglary in U.S. history. Those are two things that, I wanted to find out more information on, so I did my research and now slowly made a documentary on Phil Christopher and now doing an adaptation of the documentary and making it into a feature film.
Right. Well, that's really amazing. Our studios, Artist First, is based in Alliance, Ohio, so we've got a lot of listeners in that area, so I'm sure they're really interested in hearing about this this documentary. On that, then, tell us in a nutshell what it is about, Super Thief, your documentary.
Well, it's basically the story of Phil Christopher and finding out, who he was, how he became to be who he was, which is a master burglar and one of the top burglars in the United States, and how he was the mastermind behind the biggest bank burglary in U.S. history, and how he took, how that came to be, how that was executed. You just don't wake up one morning and say, I'm going to walk in and burglarize this bank. There has to be some kind of mindset that goes along with that. So I wanted to tap into his mind and really learn, which is something that I couldn't do in my last documentary on Danny Green, because Danny Green was obviously dead and was murdered. And Phil Christopher just did time. So when he came out, and I met him at the Cleveland Film Festival for the Danny Green screening. He sat down with Rick and I, and I told him my plan of execution, how I wanted to do this. And told him I wanted an exclusive interview, and, you know, so that way he would be a partner in the project. And just went into then doing my research and asking a bunch of questions and following up and working with the FBI in California and how they solved this incredible crime. You know, as it was an incredible crime, it was much more an incredible solving of a major burglary that back then in 1972 you just didn't have the technology like you do on CSI today. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
So,
right.
So just to learn about that was really, you know, it was fascinating to me. When I'm fascinated and have passion behind a project, I usually, you know, take the steps to execute how I want to bring it to the big screen. And naturally, a documentary is something that I do in my research, and I have, and it's a great documentary. I put together a great team, a great post-production team, and now we're working on an adaptation of the documentary into a feature film, and it's coming along great. I should have a quality screenplay probably by the end of summer that I'm happy with, that I can go start trying to put puzzle together of raising money, getting cast on that, and naturally I'm looking for Ed Norton or Jeremy Renner to be the cast in Super Thief.
Right. Well, Willie and I both saw it, and we both enjoyed it immensely, especially listening to Phil Christopher, seeing the Super Thief on the screen. What makes him a Super Thief? What qualities makes him a, you know, extra special thief?
You know, that's a great question, Ron, and I think that it was a term that was dubbed by a Cleveland reporter back in the 60s and 70s named Mary Jane Wogie. And she coined him Super Thief because he would, you know, his MO was to get in, get out, don't, you know, never go where there's, you know, people there. And a burglary is a much different mindset than a robbery. A robbery, you're attacking someone with, you know, an armed gun to, and the people are there. A burglary is against you, time, and the safe, basically. There's no
more cerebral, there. Right?
It is. And Phil Christopher was thinking about the laws of averages, and he would go at night, and frankly, he was lucky enough that he had a personality and a charisma that he knew people back then liked money. And so he used that information and the people that were in charge of certain vital information, like people that worked at ADT or a jewelry store or a cop, he would use them and put them as part of the score. So even though he would do all the work, he would still cut it up very evenly. And that was what separated him as a different kind of criminal. Burglar is that, you know, most burglars will cut your piece out and kind of hoard it for themselves. But Phil Christopher was even Steven. Even if the guys left the scene, you know, some of his crimes that he committed in the past, his burglaries, he would still cut them in.
Right.
He was a unique criminal, a very specialized burglar.
Yeah, and I got a question. I got a question for Tom Ronnie. Hey, even though he was called Super Thief, these guys made some super mistakes.
Of course.
You know,
of course.
I'm telling you, these guys, they did a heist almost the same, on the same vein as what they did before in Ohio, plus... They're all linked to a flight they all took to California.
Exactly. There were some, I mean, for as good as they were, they left the biggest pieces of the puzzle right in front of them. And they should have never have, obviously, you know, gotten on the flight with their real identifications, with all the stuff.
How did that happen? Tell us how that happened.
Oh, you know, well, I mean,
it's really amazing because they actually used their real names to get on a flight, which was one of the few pieces of evidence law enforcement had later, right?
Exactly. And what happened is that when Phil Christopher was planning everything, he was planning on having his partner at the time that he cut into all of his burglaries, Charlie Breckel, make fake identifications so they would use aliases when they got on the plane, and therefore they would never be traced to Southern California. Well, Charlie Breckel wasn't the most reliable person, and my understanding, he got a little heavy on the pills, and I think that he took too many, and he forgot that one thing was already there and didn't want to embarrass himself in front of Phil, but he still showed up. But he showed up without the fake IDs that was vital for Phil telling Charlie to be in charge of. So Phil then, with Charlie, and he fought, Phil always would fight for Charlie to be cut in. Mm-hmm. Phil was the mastermind jumper, alarm jumper, but he didn't really know the guys too well, so he'd always want someone that had his back, and he felt that at the time, Charlie Breckel had his back and was considered to be the muscle of the group. He was a hot-headed guy, kind of you didn't know which guy would come out that day, Frankenstein, if you will, or Jekyll and Mr. Hyde type of figure, and so on and so forth, that Charlie, you know, didn't want to embarrass himself, still showed up, and then Phil still got on the plane because he didn't want to embarrass himself to the D'Annunzio brothers, that that was the people who kind of introduced him to the score in California. So he wanted to save face. So they all flew out there, and they used their real names, and that was mistake number one. Obviously, then you look at how he was caught. Mistake number two was that Charlie Breckel forgot to hit the dishwasher when they were cleaning up everything. They do such an immaculate job cleaning down the walls, furniture. But the one thing Charlie Breckel was in charge of is turning on the dishwasher. So when they all leave, it's crystal clear. Everything in the dishwasher, there's no fingerprints or anything. Well, he forgot to do that. So now linking the criminals to the location of Southern California and having their fingerprints in the same location, all of them together, that was just two of the biggest mistakes, and then obviously the rest was history.
Right. Well, we're going to talk about the robbery, the United California Bank in Laguna Niguel in California. First, you know, he's considered an alarm expert and a safe man. And I'm always curious is, I mean, how do you become an alarm expert and a safe expert? I mean, you don't go to college, you know, and pick up a degree in this sort of thing. How do you get to the level that Phil got as considered the best in the business at what he did?
Well, that's a great question, Ron, and he learned at a very young age. He learned around 14, 15 years old when he started hanging around probably about guys that were 8 to 10 years older than he was, and he would learn how to crack safes. Naturally, he met through that circle of criminals and the mafia associate. He would learn through a guy named Butchie Cisternino how to start jumping alarm boxes. Him and Ronnie Crabbia kind of taught him the ways of, you know, learning the systems of bypassing alarms. So he started getting his first jump box. He learned how to start bypassing alarms. What he did was his major schooling was his uncle had a shop or a restaurant that Phil was allowed a certain room to kind of go put on alarms and have the most sophisticated alarm from ADT installed in his uncle's place and use that. So in case he ever got caught jumping out his own line, he's like, oh, I just made a mistake. Sorry, I just tripped up the alarm. But really, he was learning how to bypass the most sophisticated alarms through his own homeschooling, through his uncle's place. So he kind of had the best of both worlds. And that really, and then obviously having ADT technology people on payroll, he would learn the new devices that are coming out, which houses have them. So he was very much in the know in his area of Cleveland, Ohio, about which places to hit, which not to hit. And that's how he became such an alarm expert.
Right. Well, how did he hear about this United California Bank, which is on the other side of the country in a place called Laguna Niguel? And where is that located near?
Laguna Niguel is in Orange County, California. It's considered to be one of the nicest locations in the United States, especially on the California southern coast. And it's considered a place that the rich and famous do have residences in. Some of their homes are down there on the beachfront. It's a very small town, a beach town that now, even back then, was a very prominent area for the wealthy. And still to this day is considered to be uber wealthy. And so they would have an inside because the D'Annunzio brothers, who were also in the crime, had relatives out in Southern California that were kind of scoping out this one location, and they were telling him that, hey, this is a pretty big bank, you know, for the rich and famous down here. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of what led them out there to start scouting out the Laguna Niguel location.
Right. Well, the robbery was $30 million, which is amazing, but we're going to take a short break before we move into the second part of our interview. Willie?
You bet, Ronnie. What a fascinating subject. You're listening to Crime Beat on the Artist First World Radio Network with Ron Shepsick, and you're truly, I'll tell you, we've got a great guest. Now back to Ron and Tom.
Yes, we're back with Tommy Reed, director and producer of Super Thief. Tommy, where can our listeners get a copy of this or view this documentary?
Well, right now, it was only released as a special screening at the Cleveland International Film Festival, which we, again, had six sold-out shows in 3 days. There were the only six shows that were there. And at this time, I am holding on to the piece to either package it with the feature film that we are currently in development on, or I'm going to take the steps to sell it off separately and naturally they're going to be able to find it on DVD, Netflix, iTunes, but it's not available as of right now. I'm still in the processes of getting this project out there.
Well, they can't be too disappointed to get a piece for your work, because we got Kill an Irishman, right, which is on DVD.
That is true, and the Danny Green documentary is a special bonus feature on Kill the Irishman DVD.
Right, and there's a bonus feature, a whole documentary, so you can get that at Amazon.com, right? Would be the best place. Where else would they get that?
You can get it at any Best Buy, Costco, Walmart, and it's also available, as you mentioned, on Amazon.com and iTunes.com and on Netflix Watched Instantly.
Right. So we're talking about Super Thief documentary and Phil Christopher, who is a master safecracker, and they did get away with the $30 million. And it took a while before law enforcement finally were able to get some leads on the case, right, Tommy?
That is correct. And they committed the same type of crime, which ultimately got them caught, but what happened was they got $30 million in bear bonds. They had probably about $55,000 in cash and a lot of jewels that they could pawn off, but they had to fence the bonds, and that was the hardest thing for them. The bonds really, they were going to get anywhere from 20 to 40 cents on the dollar, depending on what they could get. Mm-hmm. So that was an instant cash, and a burglar's best thing they could ever go for is cash and diamonds, things that they can pawn off really easily. But to fence a bond, that's very difficult. You have to have a buyer for the bond. You have to have a fence location. So ultimately, when they did burglarize this epic burglary in Laguna Niguel, the Union Bank of California, in 1972, in March, they bought a boat that transferred all the funds back through New Orleans and then back up through Cleveland, where they did fence some of the bonds in New Orleans with Carlos Mosales, the mafia family down in New Orleans at the time. But they had to get more cash, because at that time, their families, it wasn't a big score for them. Yes, it was an epic proportion of the bond size, but it wasn't cash. And to divide up the pieces together, they really had to make another score. And so there was a pressure on them.
You know what it sounds like? It sounds like, Tommy, like, it sounds like they really screwed up. I mean, they pulled off a brilliant robbery, but they didn't really know what they were getting into.
You're absolutely right. And the reason why is because they never, like, when they opened up the safe, they did not enter the vault. They entered the safety deposit room of the bank, which is something that on there was a risk. There had to be some kind of risk, but they had to take it because they knew it was a very wealthy bank where the prestigious people stored their money and valuables. So they took an epic risk in going in through the safety deposit room, and them scoring the amount, they just couldn't believe their eyes. They were counting 500 million, million two, and they just couldn't believe that it kept on adding up. But for as great as it was, like I said, they only had $55,000 cash they took, which is, some of it was bank money, which had ink on there and all that other stuff. So they had to commit another burglary to satisfy the needs of what they had to do to get over the hump. Because, you know, a lot of burglars do have stashes, but when a rainy day comes, they got to keep on adding to it or they're going to use it. And it all depends on how you were spending their money back then in the early 70s, which everyone knows the 60s, right into the 70s, was a crazy time back then, especially in the underground world of Cleveland. You know, they knew they had to go for another score, so they did another score in Lordstown, Ohio, an area right around Youngstown, and they went into the Ford plant where they were going to have a payroll for that weekend, and they did the exact same type of entry, and that's what caused the red flag. And when the FBI said, oh, wow, there's another major burglary, and they probably got almost $500,000 cash on that score.
Wow.
Then they knew, you know, because the FBI was already on to, like, give me the top suspects in every major city that could commit a crime like this. So when the FBI started working with the Cleveland Police Department, they worked with some really, really special detectives and chiefs of police in that time period. Rocco Pollutro, Ed Kovacic were some of the Cleveland's finest police officers to come out of there. And the help of them with the FBI really did their homework, and that's how they solved this crime. Is that Ed Kovacic, you know, they said, hey, you know, this is a crime in the same MO, it's got to be Phil Christopher. They started, you know, kind of following them. Ed, you know, Ed kind of and Rocco kind of led them and gave them information to the FBI. The FBI wind up getting Phil, and they wind up flipping Charlie Brechtel.
They finally finally got him. He spent, we're only got a couple of minutes left, Tommy. He spent 3 years of 20 years, and then he had parole, but it was rescinded. And did he have any remorse about his life of crime? He's been 32 of 66 years in prison, which is
no,
a long time.
I think that he did his time. He paid his time.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I think that he has remorse on he knows what he did wrong that he should have never have done. And those two major mistakes, I'm sure, you know, he's mm-hmm. those are the two big ones. And, you know, and you see in the documentary, which is what everyone else is going to be able to see in the future, is that when you see him squirm in his chair about, like, he knew he went against his better judgment, and he says that, you could see that on his body. He knew he went against his better judgment, and that was his biggest mistake and why he go spend time. Was he sorry for it all? No. He was sorry for how he got caught.
Well, that's interesting to hear. Usually they're always contrite, and you always wonder if it's sincere or not. This guy is totally honest.
Right.
You know, he's not contrite, which is it's kind of refreshing. Just one last question, Tommy. How much is we know what films cost. I think your film cost $11 million. I think that's what Rick said that the Killing Irishman cost. What does a documentary like this cost to produce?
Well, the average documentary out there today costs right around $500,000.
Wow.
So, I'm going to say that I'm below the average of that price, but that's what I mean, and a lot of it, you got to understand, is stock footage and post-production costs.
Right.
So if you want to have a quality, you got to get the stock footage from everywhere.
You got it. You're right. You got it, and that costs money. We're going to have to go, Tommy, and we're going to get you back on when the film is in production to talk about what you're doing, and you could explain filmmaking to us, you know, putting together a crime feature film. That would be great, you know, from beginning to end. I think a lot of our listeners are interested in that sort of thing. Thank you, Tommy Reed, for being on the show and for introducing our listeners to a really fascinating character, Phil Christopher.
Guys, thank you so much. I really appreciate your time. Your radio show is fantastic, and God bless.
Okay,
thanks, Tommy.
Thank you, Tommy. And, Willie, let's take a break, and we'll be back with the second part of our show.
You bet. You're listening to Crime Beat on the Artist First World Radio Network with Ron Chapsick and Will Harib. While our production staff hooks up with our guests for the second half of our program, we'll take a brief musical interlude.
Crime Beat executive producer Ron Chepsik is not only a co-host of the show, he's also a crime writer and a publisher of other talented writers as well. Go to the publisher's website at strategicmediabooks.com to check these popular books out. Ron's books include the award-winning Sergeant Smack, The Lives and Times of Ike Atkinson, Kingpin and His Band of Brothers, which has been optioned for a movie, Queenpins, the first book exclusively about women gangsters, The Traficantes, Godfathers from Tampa, Florida, The Mafia, The CIA, and The JFK Assassination. You can also buy books by such noted true crime authors such as Pat O'Connor, author of Scapegoat, Scott Deitch, author of Rogue Mobster, Scott Wilson, author of Straight from the Hood, and Seth Ferranti, author of Prison Stories. Keep up with the new books coming out by joining the company's hot new mailing list. To get on it, email strategicmediabooks@gmail.com. That's STRATEGIC, mediabooks@gmail.com. The books from Strategic Media Books are also available at Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com and through your favorite bookstore. When you go to Strategic Media Books' website, mention that you caught the buzz from the Crime Beat radio show and you will get $3 off any purchase. Again, the website is StrategicMediaBooks.com, STRATEGIC, MediaBooks.com. Come on down and you won't be disappointed.
And now back to Crime Beat on the Artist First World Radio Network.
Thanks, Corey. Thanks a lot. Tonight, in our second half, we bring you also another award-winning documentary filmmaker, Mr. Yuri Luhovy, and Professor Roman Serban, who will discuss Mr. Luhovy's documentary titled Genocide Revealed. It's the story of the man-made famine called the Holodomor, perpetrated by Joseph Stalin in 1932-1933, which reportedly killed upwards of 10 million Ukrainians. Stick around. You won't want to miss this interview. Take it away, Ronnie.
Thank you, Willie, and welcome to the show, Yuri Luhovy and Roman Serban.
Hi, pleased to meet you.
Great. Well, this is a really powerful documentary. I watched it, and I was really moved by the story, and the story of the Holodomor. Tell us briefly, what is your documentary about, and what are you trying to say with it as a filmmaker, Yuri?
Well, first of all, we never knew too much about the Holodomor when we were educated in the school system. I heard the first time about it from my mother, although she never dwelled on it. And later on, I participated at some filming session where I met, I knew about Dr. Serbin, but actually he had a big symposium in Montreal, the first symposium ever, I think, on the subject of the famine of 1932-33, and I was invited to film it, and I got hooked in a sense. How come I don't know about this? How come we were never taught about this in our school system? And basically, the film portrays I'm trying to show why the famine happened in 1932-33. I also want to know, I wanted to go to these areas that was forbidden for so long in the central and eastern, eastern Ukraine, under the communists. Mm-hmm. And this happened. And also, I was dying, being over 35 years in the film industry, I was dying to see what kind of archives I could find there, because archives also were forbidden up to the 90s. So an earlier film we did was called Harvest of Despair. About right. This was to commemorate the 50th anniversary, and we had such a difficulty to find stock shots, so we went to 12 different libraries throughout the world to try to find some material. But there was a wealth of material in Kyiv. Basically, they were propaganda film, but we used those to tell the story of the time.
Right. Well, you talk about a famine, but it was a holocaust in every sense of the term, right, Professor Serbin?
Yes, it was a genocide. Now, I think we should limit the term holocaust to the Jewish genocide and use the term Holodomor for the Ukrainian genocide. Both terms are a bit misleading if you go to the actual sense, original sense of the word. A holocaust means sacrifice by immolation. Well, there was no sacrifice. It was just mass murder of the Jewish population. And the same thing with Holodomor. When you talk about Holodomor, the original words mean to kill by famine. But the Holodomor, in the sense of genocide, was much broader than just killing the peasant population by famine. So, so I think that this is also worth it. Making it a little bit more precise. It was genocide, and genocide, according to the United Nations Convention, is an act with the intent. The intent is very important. And the intent to destroy in whole or in part, and then it names a certain number of groups, actually four groups. The intent in the case of the Holodomor was to destroy the Ukrainian nation, not the whole Ukrainian nation, because, 30 million people. If Stalin wanted to kill off 30 million people, who would be doing the work? It was to destroy a part of that nation, and that fits into the United Nations Convention of Genocide. Right. And that part of the nation included not just the peasants, it also included the intellectuals, and actually included also the elites of Ukraine, because it's the elites of Ukraine that could provide an opposition to Stalin's regime. And so you have to dispose of them first, and then you dispose of a part of the peasantry. And in this way, you break the backbone of the nation, and then you do with the rest what you want.
Right. Well, the figure that is usually used is 10 million people were killed and murdered during the Holodomor. How do we come at that figure?
We'll never
is that an accurate figure in your respect, and how is it determined?
Well, in my case, I interviewed some interesting people in villages, and they said that basically, and I met a gentleman that was elderly now, of course, but at the time he was 14 years old from an orphanage. The father put him in an orphanage for him to survive, and he was taken in a group where he would collect bodies. And I specifically asked him, did you actually write down the names of people who died? Did you actually take account of how many bodies you were putting in a pit or anything like that? And he says, no, there was no accounting at all. And the other difficulty was that when there were accounts made of the death, the amount of people that died, Stalin had an order to get rid of all the registers, and a few of them survived in Ukraine, luckily, that they can sort of figure out what happened. And another lady also said that she read a list in the village that was formed to know how many died in that village. She says half of them were missing. So it's very difficult to assess that. And some specialists say from 3 to 12, you know, so you can't tell.
Right.
It doesn't really matter the number at the one at one
no,
point.
It's still a horrendous figure, and it was mass murder. Any way you look at it. So, how did Stalin go about implementing his program, and how did this lead to famine, which led to millions of people dying?
I think so. Dr. Serbin can reply. Yeah. The only thing I would like to say that he wanted to make to industrialize the country and. By doing so, he needed a lot of cash, and the only way he can get cash is through, today we have the petrol as the currency of the day. At that time, it was the wheat, and the people that had the wheat were Ukrainians mainly. But,
and Ukraine was the breadbasket.
He
was the breadbasket, right, on that very, very important. But there were mass executions, right, because there was tremendous resistance, right, to... Stalin's program.
In 1930, in 4 months, there was over 1,700 uprising, and the secret police assessed at least 15 to be very widespread, and that in 32 also, and to a point, the uprising was happening, and I think because of these uprising, the famine followed in a sense because he wanted to break the backbone of Ukrainians.
Wow!
I think you have to put it in historical perspective. You know, the Soviet Union lasted for 70 years, and the process bringing about the power of the communist regime in the whole empire, because it wasn't just Ukraine, it was Russia and other republics, I mean up to 15 republics at one time. To bring the power about, it took a long time. First of all, after the revolution, to get the Ukrainians to accept the communist power, they introduced a policy of Ukrainization. In other words, this was to bring in the Ukrainian language and so on in Ukraine, because 80% of the population of Ukraine was Ukrainian speaking, was Ukrainian language, used Ukrainian language. So they introduced Ukrainian language, and in this way tried to get the Ukrainians to come to accept the regime. And with the Ukrainian language came the... self-consciousness or consciousness, national consciousness and so on, and Ukrainian culture thrived and so on. And what was happening is the cities were becoming Ukrainian, Ukraine was becoming Ukrainian, and the Ukrainians started to say, well, we're being exploited by Moscow, we're being exploited, they're taking stuff away from us, this is not in our interest. And this became a danger to the regime. And at the same time, Stalin had was in the process of eliminating his adversaries within the party, and he had to see how he would keep Ukraine within the Soviet Empire. And so by the end of 1920s, Stalin decided to really make it into a totalitarian, authoritarian country, and the threat from Ukraine became very ominous. So at the end of 1920s, 1929, as a matter of fact, GPU, which was the NKVD of that time, or GPU of that time, prepared some cases. They put together a conspiracy in Ukraine, and they arrested a large number, up to 700 people, Ukrainian intellectuals and so on. And these people were put on trial. It was one of the first show trials in the Soviet Union. Actually, was held in the theater. It was really a show trial. And these people were condemned, and eventually many of them died in the gulag and so on. This was one way to eliminate the leadership that would lead the Ukrainians to a more open revolt. And then at the same time, 29 began the collectivization and what's called dekulakization. In other words, the kulaks, or the rich, the more wealthy peasants, also the more educated and so on. In other words, the leadership of the peasantry in Ukraine, and peasantry was about 80% of the Ukrainian population then, these people were also dekulakized. In other words, they were deprived of their wealth, and this wealth was turned over to the new collectives that were being created. And this was also a way of eliminating the leadership in the countryside. The peasants would be led by these kulaks who were now being eliminated. And so, in other words, from 29 on, the leadership both in the country, the intelligentsia, and in the countryside were eliminated, and then the regime had to deal directly with the peasants. Now, the peasants were forced into the collectives. They didn't want to, because in Ukraine, farmers were used to having their own property, not like in Russia. In Russia, they had what was called an obshchina, which was sort of a commune. It wasn't exactly a kolkhoz, but it was something halfway between a private property and a collective. In Ukraine, it was strictly a private property. So Ukrainians objected, revolted, and as Yuri mentioned, there were uprisings and so on. These were put down by force, and eventually all these, or most of the Ukrainian peasants, were driven into the collectives. So by 1932, actually, when the famine, the Great Famine, started, most of the Ukrainian peasants were already in the collectives. But they were still grumbling, and so the final solution for Stalin, in other words, to settle everything once and for all, was to bring about this punishment of the peasants and introduce these excessive requisitions, which deprived the peasants not only of the wheat, but also of everything else that they could eat. So they tried to survive as they could, but eventually, you know, several million, we don't know exactly what figure, it's probably somewhere around 5 or 6 million. I personally prefer to use the figure 6 million, but we don't have exact records of it. These people were eliminated, physically eliminated.
Yeah, I've got a question.
Before you go on, Willie, we're going to take a short break. We haven't got much time. We only got about 5 minutes. So let's take a short break. Go ahead.
Okay, right after the break, I'm going to jump in with a question. You're listening to Crime Beat on the Artist First World Radio Network with Ron Chapsik and Will Hareb. Our guests are Yuri Lahovi and Professor Roman Serban. Well, Ronnie, this one I've got for Dr. Roman.
Before we continue, genocide revealed, where can our listeners get a copy of your documentary?
People can go to my site, www.yluhovy.com. It's spelled Y-L-U-H-O-V-Y, and it's readily available. Earlier I said I never learned about the famine genocide. This is why we're doing right now a 26-minute version of the same film, of the 75-minute, and a 52-minute version, so that teachers can decide if they have the time in class to show it. And we're going to do this, hopefully by September, we'll have a new version for schools, an educational version.
Well, why is it such a forgotten chapter of history? You know, I mentioned people that you were going to be on the show, you two gentlemen, and, you know, they said, the what? The Holodomor, you know, and people don't really know much about it, yet it's one of the big, incredible, cases of mass murder in world history.
As your show says, it's a crime.
Well, you know, all the other genocides that we know about in the 20th century and even more recent events, which have the genocidal aspect about it, usually happened before the eyes of the world. Even the Armenian genocide, I mean, immediately after the genocide, or very shortly after it, it became known in the world, and Turkey was on the wrong side. The same thing with the Holocaust. Germany was on the wrong side. They lost the war, and the genocide there were caught there red-handed, whereas the Ukrainian genocide was done by in a country that was not a war, in a country, the Soviet Union, that had the West had no access to it or very little access to it, and then after the war, it was on the winning side. So of course, nobody was going to talk about the Ukrainian genocide. Mm-hmm. They were not going to talk against their allies, who helped them win the Second World War. So this is one reason why the West did not, or knew about it, but did not really highlight it.
Right.
One thing that I wanted to mention is one of the witnesses, I'm sorry to interject, it's that when I finish, and it happened every time we've put away the camera and put it in the minibus while we were traveling, they, at the beginning, the witnesses were very forthcoming with their story. Finally, I'll be able to tell what I have to tell and what I saw and everything. As soon as we put the camera away, this fear that they have talked came back to haunt them. And what are you going to do with this material? Oh, they can come for me tomorrow. I don't care. I had to tell it. You know, they still had that fear. And don't forget, anybody mentioning the famine during that time was either killed or was sent to the gulags. Mm-hmm. So that they never were able to talk about it, you know. And then World War II came in, and again another tragedy, you know.
Yeah. Well, I've got one.
Did you have any questions?
Yes, I did. Thanks, Ronnie. This is one for Dr. Servan. You know, as we know, the Russians have refused to admit anything about the Holodomor, anything. With President Yanukovych in power today, who enjoys quite a lot of support from the Russian government, what is the current official view of the Holodomor under his regime?
We've got about a couple of minutes left, gentlemen.
Yanukovych does not recognize it as a genocide, the Russians don't recognize the Ukrainian Holodomor as a genocide. There's one thing you must understand. The Russians are trying to recreate what they call the Ruski Mir, in other words, the Russian world. And they consider Ukraine as part of that Russian world. And anything that, especially a great event like the Ukrainian genocide, that separates Ukrainian history from Russian history is a no-no for them. And that's why most of the Russian historians who quote who follow the line, the official line, will not publicly admit that this was a genocide in Ukraine. This is unfortunately, but that's what's happening in Russian history and politics.
The first thing that happened when Yanukovych took power, the official on his official site as a president, the Holodomor was taken off. That's even before he became president. And the other thing is now we have a huge threat with the language issue, where they want to impose the language, the Russian language, and they're doing it in the parliament right now, which is a big shame.
Right.
They want to kill again, do a linguicide to destroy the Ukraine. It's a constant policy that has been throughout the centuries with the Russians.
Thank you very much. We wish we had a little more time to get into this fascinating and important subject. We welcome you gentlemen to the show. And again, for listeners who want to get a copy and see this powerful documentary, Genocide Revealed, Yuri, tell us again where they can go.
They can go to www.yluhovy, it's spelled LUHOVY.com, yluhovy.com.
And any of our listeners that want more information can email us at crimebeat123@yahoo.com, and we will provide you with that. Thank you again, gentlemen, and we
thank
hope
you
to
have Дуже дякую, дуже дякую, добраніч.
Добраніч.
Okay. Well, Ronnie, thanks again to our very special guest. and Mr. Yuri Lohovi and Dr. Roman Serban. We were delighted to have them on our program. Hey, Ronnie, what a great documentary show tonight. What did you learn about our show this evening?
Well, when people listen to shows like this one we just had, they can really understand why documentary filmmaking is such a powerful art form. It's a great way for telling a story, and both of our guests, the directors, did a great job, and to get a chance to see Genocide Revealed, we hope they buy a copy, and also Strictly should be out soon, and if not, you get a copy of Kill an Irishman, an example of Tommy Beat's work. Willie?
Well, you know, first part of the interview, I learned quite a bit that robbing banks takes a lot of effort. You know, it's a dangerous occupation, but Phil Christopher made it look easy, but he made a lot of mistakes, too. He was a super thief, and he made a couple of super mistakes. Also, I learned that Yuri Lohovi's documentary shows how the Soviet Union covered up one of the most horrific mass murders in history and continues to do just that under the Russian regime with Putin under the helm. It's an important documentary that should be distributed to all schools, really, in North America. Excuse me. Now, just a reminder for all you listeners out there, our next program is scheduled for July the 12th, 2012, excuse me, where we'll feature a crime fiction show. We have Ed Falco, who will discuss his book titled Family Corleone. Also, we'll bring you popular crime fiction writer John Land, who will discuss his just-released novel titled Strong Vengeance. It's going to be a great show, so make sure you mark it on your calendar. You won't want to miss that one. We hope you enjoyed Crime Beat this evening on the Artist First World Radio Network with Ron Shevsick and yours truly. For all you out there, you can listen to our past Crime Beat programs anytime by going to the archive on the Artist First World Radio Network. You can also email us at crimebeat123@yahoo.com, and please spread the word about our program. And until next week, and on behalf of Ron Shevsick and myself, we hope you tune into Crime Beat next Thursday, same time at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, where you want to have a front row seat to the fascinating world of crime. Have a pleasant evening, everybody. Good night, Ronnie.
Sleep tight, Willie.